old great uncle Samwise Flour Dumpling Proudneck Wolf. Still, he had a good run, 101 years old. I don't really recognize any of the people here at the funeral home. It must be the Saxville Wolves from West Farthing. We never did mix much with them. I'm gonna grab a selfie and tweet it out to my peeps. Checking in from the service for Uncle Samwise. Very sad. What's everybody doing later? Okay, done. But you know, the picture didn't have the coffin in it. Or that lady with the great hat. Maybe if I just stand here and angle my phone this way. And another tweet. We'll really miss Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam! I never noticed that before. Everybody always called him Samwise. That's so funny. And check out the hat on this lady behind me. And tweet it.
Excuse me, miss. Are you here for the Brandy Buck Boffin Memorial Service?
No, the Samwise Flour Dumpling Proudneck Wolf Service.
Alas, that is tomorrow. And the people gathered here are unhappy with your practice of taking pictures of yourself.
Really? Because everybody does funeral selfies these days. But whatever, I'll come back tomorrow. But before I go, can you just stand a little closer to me for a second? Check out me with totes adorable, grumpy funeral guy. Wrong day, my bad. Now listen to a radio show with this host who banned everything except lithographs at his funeral. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, that's right. There's all kinds of rules about my funeral. And yeah, nothing more contemporary than an engraving may be done at it. All right, so we're live from downtown Hartford. How about repping the 860? Let's hear some noise. That's all Gloria Allred and her staff of attorneys. They're here having a press conference as well. We're sharing the space with them. It's co-working. All right, so we're here on Trumbull Street, embedded in the XL Center. We're thrilled to be here. If you're working in downtown Hartford and you want to come by and join the audience, that's fine. We'll be doing our regular no-show, except we're just sitting in a different place, that's all. With us today, James Hanley from Trinity Cine Studio, Carolyn Payne from the Kinetic Dance Company, and also owner of a thriving comedy and acting career, and musician and producer extraordinaire Jim Chapdelaine. That's our panel today. And as the, I'll tell you later in the show, we will talk a little bit about Rand Paul's, we're going to talk about PR disasters. We love public relations disasters. So Rand Paul's got one, and he's plagiarizing from Wikipedia, apparently. And although as Stephen Colbert pointed out last night, for all we know, Rand Paul wrote the Wikipedia entry about Gattaca that he plagiarized. It could be. Also, Jay-Z is caught in kind of a crossfire involving Barney's, an upscale New York clothier that's now accused of racial profiling. And actually, there is kind of a PR disaster unfolding right before our very eyes. It really is true. Gloria Allred is in downtown Hartford for another press conference about UConn. So we may get to that. We may not. We also want to talk a little bit about sort of what happens when there's a piece of culture or art out there that you're interested in, but it's created by somebody loathsome. The latest example being Orson Scott Card, who at least many people find loathsome, and his book is the basis for the movie Ender's Game, which is opening this weekend. Yeah, you might be curious about it for a whole bunch of different reasons. You might be troubled about his politics. So how do you navigate that whole question? Towards the end of the show, of course, endorsements by the panel. But we are, as the introduction suggested, fascinated this week by the notion of funeral selfies. We're fascinated by the idea that there could be such a thing, but it might be defensible, too. We'll find out. In fact, this week, Fast Company writer Jason Pfeiffer started a Tumblr devoted to funeral selfies, selfies at funerals. These are, for the most part, things that wind up on Twitter or Instagram. So we have three digital media represented already, Tumblr, the Twitter, the Instagram. And I guess, really, a lot of the pictures are taken before the funeral or after the funeral. You know, the kids are all dressed up. These are young people, for the most part, who do this, and they're taking a self-portrait. Maybe it's in their home. Maybe it's outside the funeral home, wherever. Sometimes it really is at the funeral. Even if there aren't a lot of them now, unfortunately, I think there are going to be more and more of them. So I'm sort of curious to know even whether there's any defense for this. There might be. There might be. I mean, we could just be all grumpy people. So let's go to the, let's start with the least old and least grumpy person here. That would be Carolyn Payne. No, it's not you, Jim.
I'm definitely the least old, but I don't know about the least grumpy. I'm pretty, pretty rage-filled.
Well, you're crashing from Halloween candy right now, but but I don't know. How does this, how does this look to you? What, does this just sort of fit in with a general trend of digital narcissism, or is
yeah, everyone's taking selfies everywhere. I'm containing myself right now to not take a selfie. While
go ahead. Knock yourself out.
But I do think that it's just this documentation culture. It's sort of everyone is their own paparazzi. Everyone wants to document where they are, what they're doing, and I think the disturbing trend with this, I went through the Tumblr and tried to. And the ones where it was like, this is my funeral outfit, snap. And that, I felt, that's where I drew the line. Like, I get, you know, wanting to document where you are and kind of use that as some sort of cathartic way to express where you're at. But once it's about, you know, documenting how cute your funeral shoes are, I lose you on that. But everyone, I mean, there are selfies. That's what Instagram is for, right? Selfies of you doing everything awesome and making people jealous of your life or making people comment. That's sadly what we're about.
James, you were going to chime
in
there?
Well, I think it's kind of an irony, given the news of the past few days, that there is there's been a breach of the most secure servers of Google and all the major suppliers of online stuff, and also the fact that in places like London, for example, there are, I think, now nearly 350,000 cameras on the streets, all of which are connected to a computer system that is doing face recognition. And now you have the Instagram library and all of the selfies from funerals that are also going to be face recognition checked. And it's all this massive thing that it's really no surprise, but it's sort of like amusing to me that people are doing it from this point of view of a social thing, you know, making a statement and taking a picture at a funeral. But it's all sort of playing into this incredibly pervasive awareness of your face that, you know, you trip up somewhere and all of a sudden this is going to be brought up in front of you, including the funeral.
Well, and there's a funeral face that these people are making. It's kind of the equivalent of duck face, but it's kind of like the sad pout, like this.
It's sort of the selfie standard, though, right? Isn't that? I mean, I have a 14-year-old daughter.
Yeah, it's the distortion of the lens of a cell phone.
Yeah,
the
selfie standard is the duck face. I don't know why everyone has decided that their face looks best when they, you know, suck it in and try to chisel out some cheekbones for themselves. But the selfie.
You haven't been around a 14-year-old in a while, and I am surrounded. And I'd say it's a minimum of 1,000. Selfies a day for a 14-year-old, and in every
you don't try to impose some kind of limit or curfew on selfies.
I've tried. I'm trying everything. You know, I'm at work right now with Verizon to devise some sort of scheme.
But I don't want the unlimited account.
Yeah, I really don't. Yeah, please don't. Please stop something. So I think there's two things that selfies are so much a part of that culture that it's inevitable. I mean, I was first thinking like, how are these dead people doing it? But somehow they've managed to take selfies,
that kind of people.
Casket selfies. Yeah. Like, wow, that's really good. I want to be able to do that. But secondly, I think there's a discomfort with death with young people and the idea that they're never going to die. And I can tell you, even having had my own scheduled several times and just failing to show up for it, going to a wake with my brother and finding myself in this uncomfortable position where we were kneeling at this open casket and they had sewed this bizarre grin on this woman. And I said to my brother, I think she likes you. And that just led to that uncomfortable church laugh that you're always trying to stifle. And to the point where we were in tears, and I said, just grab my arm. We got to get out of here. And I burst into tears. And we ran off. And we were asked later, like, geez, we didn't know you were that close. I said, yeah, we were pretty close. But I think there is a discomfort at that age. You're just discovering death.
Well, you know, and there is, I mean, this is part of a, first of all, I want to salute James for, you know, we always like to have sort of an informal title of any episode of The Nose we do. I think this has to be the Pervasive Awareness of Your Face episode of The Nose. what a great phrase. But, I mean, there's sort of a general erosion of funeral customs anyway. And, in fact, in Connecticut, they're revising regulations because people want to have food and drink in funeral homes because people can never not be eating or drinking. So they have to do this during memorial services. And, you know, increasingly, as you watch life unfold, you know, I go to wakes and memorial services at funeral homes, and people are, like, in shorts and T-shirts. And there's the whole idea that you have to sort of... I mean, I'm almost thrilled that anybody's dressed up enough in somber enough clothes that they really do want to take a picture of themselves
Speedos.
To document that fact. Yeah, I mean, it really does. It's an indication anyway, because I'm always kind of... I mean, everything's become a casual Friday, including... your funeral. And the other thought that I had when you were talking too, and you know, James, there is this, I don't know why I just addressed it to James, but there's this custom, I think it's mainly a Victorian or pre-Victorian custom of the death mask.
Right.
You know. Yeah. Well, why bother?
Just why bother?
You
right?
you got your camera, you got
death
your cell phone.
Selfie.
Well, even in Victorian era or early I guess it had to be after that, early camera era, they took pictures of people,
right.
You know, they
That's
would
right.
set up, they would stage, like, death photos
right,
after
right.
the person died. Like, yeah. if your child yeah. died young, you would set up a family portrait. So, I mean, that's right. horribly creepy, so I guess...
And it involved standing still for a really long time with the body. I mean, it was a very bizarre sort of scene. But I think that sort of plays into this whole thing that now, with the technology we have, it's possible to have this video soundtrack, and sound is coming next, of course, on these selfies, is that those are things that people do now. It's the constant presence of everything you do that plays into this. And if this is also naturally going into these vast banks of servers in Utah and elsewhere, and all of these things are put together, it suddenly reminded me of a book I read 2 years ago by Ray Kurzweil called The Singularity. And I thought, you know, what's going to happen with all of these things when the singularity
happens? When the robots enslave us?
Well, the singularity is the time when all of this stuff becomes aware of itself, which... you know, nobody really knows whether it will happen, but if it happens, it'll happen sort of instantly, and all of a sudden it'll be presented with all these selfies amongst all the other pictures, and so they'll then be concatenated with everything else.
It's going to
be interesting.
Robots will have French Revolution-style trials,
yes,
which people are forced
absolutely.
To explain why they took selfies in certain situations.
Absolutely, yes.
And
this will be the new entertainment.
Robots will
right.
take selfies, too.
Well...
Eventually.
We don't know that.
Yeah,
they may not be as narcissistic. But it is, I mean, you know, James is making a great point, which is there's a profound irony on the one hand, standing up for and idolizing people like Edward Snowden for the kinds of revelations that they've brought to us, important, you know, Glenn Greenwald and everybody else, and then taking pictures of yourself, which get contributed to the
exactly.
exact phenomenon
right.
that you're deploring. Yeah. So I do feel eventually, anyway, based on everything that you're saying, people who are young now, their memorial services will just be cradle-to-grave multimedia shows. I mean, every picture, every moment of their life will right. have been photographed.
Well, there may not be any need to attend, actually.
Right.
Yeah, a friend of mine had this... idea that he wanted to create a tombstone that is digital so that you can go up to it and it'll be like a touch screen. It'll have your Facebook timeline and pictures and you can enter a year and view. And he was just
You
so
should remind him that only three people will ever go to that.
Yeah. Nobody would want that.
Still, I would crowdfund it.
Yeah. But he was so convinced that this was a brilliant idea. He was like, I should trademark this. But,
right.
I mean, in some ways that, you know, our Facebook, our digital... mediums that are what we are going to be leaving behind.
Well,
and
there is software now. I mean, for instance, the software company that monitors the large input of pictures from the street in cities like London and now New York, the same company is doing it, actually has terminals that as people are passing through the street, it brings up their lives, essentially.
Oh,
it
God.
Does link these pictures.
That's comforting.
So it's actually, that's already here.
Minority Report. By the way, we do have a floating mic here. If you want to chime in on this, we're going to move on to another topic pretty quickly. But if there's anybody who has, you could be part of the nose.
Has anyone taken a selfie during this?
You could be a nostril for just a second.
It'd only be
Stick
appropriate
up your hand if you want to. Otherwise, I think what we may do is kind of get ready for a break here. We've got a whole slew of other topics we want to cover. We've even got a reserve tank of topics today in case we burn through these too fast. But that doesn't seem to be happening anyway. So let's grab a break here. We're live in downtown Hartford on Trumbull Street. Come on by if you want to. Otherwise, stay tuned. We'll be back. One Betsy Kaplan, two Betsy Kaplan, three Betsy Kaplan.
Can we photobomb?
I'm bored, so I'ma take a selfie. I'm obsessed, it's unhealthy. Click, share, I don't care that I'm a man. I'ma take another pic and I'ma post Instagram.
I'm bored, so I'ma take a selfie. I'm obsessed, it's unhealthy. Click, share, I don't care that I'm a man. I'ma take another pic and I'ma post Instagram.
I'ma take a selfie of me taking a selfie.
And we're back. Prove that we're in Hartford, live audience. Make some noise. There we go. I suppose we could have had that recorded somehow. It doesn't really prove anything, does it? But it might prove something. We are here. We're doing the nose with James Hanley, Carolyn Payne, and Jim Chapdelaine. We're on Trumbull Street of Hartford. If you're taking a lunch break, come on over, and you can eat while we talk. We're going to leave off funeral selfies and move on to even more profound issues. We're going to look at some PR disasters that did happen this week, starting with Rand Paul. Senator Rand Paul was appearing, and this is one of these noses where I was like the least prepared person because I'd just been drowning in stuff all week, so the panel kept telling me all these really cool things. And so somebody, anyway, brought me up to date on the Rand Paul's problem, that he was appearing on behalf of a candidate named Ken Cuccinelli, who has enough problems as it is. He's a gubernatorial candidate in Virginia. One of the things he wants to do is outlaw oral sex for everybody. Personally, this isn't something I would bring up during my campaign if I were running for anything. I would wait till like the inaugural ball and say, by the way, I didn't get around to mentioning this, but you can't do that anymore. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about, thank God. What we're here to talk about is the fact that Rand Paul showed up on behalf of him, one of the many people stumping for him as he runs against Terry McAuliffe, and was trying to sort of invoke a sort of James Hanley alarming futuristic scenario, and this one based on the movie Gattaca. The problem was his invocation of the movie Gattaca was ripped word for word from the Wikipedia entry for Gattaca, which some people are taking issue with. Jim Chapdelaine, do you take issue with this? Or maybe Wikipedia is such that nobody
I'm not sure. Randall Howard Rand Paul, born January 7th, 1963, is the junior United States Senator for Kentucky. Yeah, I do take issue with it. I mean, he's sort of running for president, and he's reading Wikipedia. I mean, we've had an actor. I'm not quite sure that qualifies you. This is the first time. And I think any time he's referenced a movie or popular culture, he's read directly from Wikipedia, which is sort of a democratic news source, not Democrat with a capital D, but it's self-correcting to an extent, but it's not always accurate. But to go in and really lift it word for word and then read it with an emotive kind of way and not acknowledge it, because he was reading it as if he was just speaking extemporaneously.
It's a gift.
Yeah.
It's a gift. It's a talent.
Yeah.
Well, it is, you know, James Hanley, you and I over the years have had many conversations going back literally decades about the way in which political figures and news commentators often do try to make a point about something real by invoking a movie.
Right.
And quite frequently it'll be something like, I mean, I think our conversations about this may go back as far as Somalia, where news commentators and politicians were saying, it's like Mad Max. It's like The Road Warrior.
Right.
And it's, I think you said at the time, it's sort of the final insult. First of all, we create these conditions.
Right.
And then we compare them to some movie we know about. And now we're in the third iteration of it, which was we can't even be bothered to come up with original language to
right.
compare things to a movie.
That's the core of this, is that now there's no substance behind it. It's almost like it was written
right.
by a PR person who sees Rand Paul as being on the cusp of an age problem in running for president. And therefore, he has to show his relevance by a cultural awareness, say, you know, make a movie reference. But the problem with movie references, pop culture references generally, is that you better know the background and you better know what it meant. Was it ironic? Was it real? Did you see the movie? You know, and none of that seems to be true with Rand Paul. Rand Paul sort of has a kind of like manic sort of self-presentation that when you read the Wikipedia thing and you heard the way, just as Jim was saying, the tone of voice he used, it was like the whole thing was false and manipulated.
Well, it was like he was delivering a lecture and he had carefully crafted everything. I think he would have been better off, if he wanted to be relevant, to go to a funeral and take a selfie.
That's right.
He was trying to appear hip and now.
Yeah.
That's what that may be coming. Although part of this is, well, first of all, Carolyn, I haven't heard you on this. I mean, does this strike you? I mean, plagiarism, I don't know. I mean, there's something a little dirty and skulky about plagiarism, no matter who does it.
Yeah, and I think that plagiarism with Wikipedia is an interesting thing because it becomes an issue of who are you plagiarizing from.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So you have that. And then also the fact that it was a movie reference, that he's, you know, plagiarizing the plot of a movie, somehow just makes this pitiful to me. Yeah. That he couldn't, you know, he just couldn't watch the movie and sum it up in his own words.
Well,
exactly. Yeah. But with movies, it's also a questionable thing because, you know, a lot of times if you're describing a movie to someone, I found myself relaying what the Netflix summary of it was.
Yes, yeah.
And so it kind of fell into this sort of gray area for me, but then the more I thought about it, the more pathetic I thought
Plus,
it was.
You're not running for president.
Right. Well,
I don't think.
I
when
think
you're talking to your friend,
at least that we know.
You may.
Yeah, there's a kind of pathetic quality to it, but the way it's delivered. But I think there's also a cynical interpretation of it, or more cynical interpretation of it, which is that a man like him has already hired a PR outfit, an expensive PR outfit, and they've laid this out for him. And I think that there's a lot of people who are doing those things who feel that the general public doesn't really know the story, like they haven't read the Wikipedia article, they're not really engaged on it, so actually plagiarism is something you can get away with. And I think that's a message. That's the sort of, I was saying in one of the emails we exchanged about, it's a Trojan horse kind of thing. It's constantly pushing limits to somehow say, okay, well, it's all right to plagiarize, really, and it's not a big deal, you know.
And maybe not more than 137 people saw Gattaca.
Yeah.
So he's assuming that this is a pretty obscure reference.
Yeah, it's safe to do it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Other Ethan Hawke movies, you'd have to be more careful. I will say this. I do think one of the interesting areas is about Wikipedia itself, which Wikipedia obviously is part of kind of an intellectual force we think of as the commons, you know, this notion that it is shared information, which to a certain degree people are invited to make use of. I mean, to be intellectually honest, you want to say where you got it from and that you're using it. It's also obviously, in all the ways that you guys are suggesting, the last refuge of careless and time-pressed college students who, you know, will turn to that rather than to a real source, to a direct source. But you can kind of understand, anyway, in an era of intellectual sloppiness, why somebody would think that taking stuff from Wikipedia is different from taking stuff from a source with a known and identified author. Now, yeah. Thomas Mallon, by the way, has written a fabulous book about plagiarism, about the whole history of plagiarism, all the people who've done it. But in general, one of the notions of plagiarism is that there's a victim, you know, that I wrote these words, and now you're using them as your own. And one difference between most plagiarism and Wikiplagiarism is that there's no, I think you said it, Carolyn, there's no known author. You don't really know who it is that
it's
you're
stealing
from.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if that makes it a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony or not.
Well,
but
you know, I would say, speaking to the authenticity of that, kids in junior high school are prohibited from using that as their primary source. I mean, we all, you know, did book reports or whatever where we furiously copied the Encyclopedia Britannica and paraphrased it and tried to move the sentences convincingly so that these were original thoughts. But even at the junior high school level, kids are prohibited. Like, you can't go to Wikipedia because it's not reliable. So I think if it's prohibited in junior high school and high school as your primary source, if you're going to run for the highest office, you might want to consider some of those just basic rules.
On the other hand, you might actually be trying to dumb down the whole nature of knowledge and intellect and intellectual honesty, and therefore, you know, like scattershot, destroy everything, and then you appear to be smart because you appear to know something. I mean, I know that's cynical, but hey.
Well, maybe you're giving him the same credit that he's not giving the popular culture.
It's a nice lesson. It's a nice lesson anyway to all of us. I mean, I occasionally do teach digital culture at Trinity, and one of the points that I make to people about knowledge is that I sort of analogize between a bridge and a car. You know, you're going to buy a car, you really do find out as much as you can about the car. You know, you do some research, you test drive it, you compare things, you acquire a lot of sense of what kind of thing you're dealing with. You drive across a bridge, I mean, you don't do a lot of research on it in advance. Find out how sound it is. You just assume the bridge is going to work. The problem with Wikipedia and a lot of other digital information is people treat it like a bridge when it's really a car. And a Wikipedia entry, you know, it could be a lot of different things. It could be that the part of the Wikipedia entry that Rand Paul quoted is plagiarized from somewhere else. It actually sounds like it. It begins a little bit different from an encyclopedia entry. It does begin, unfortunately for me, it begins in the exact words of the Mystery Science Theater 3000 jingle, which I've had stuck in my head all day.
I think you should sing it.
It begins in the not-too-distant future, which isn't really how ordinarily an encyclopedic entry begins, which makes me think it might actually be taken from.
Well, that might have been the meme that they got him to remember it with.
Right. So let's talk about, as long as we're talking about PR disasters, let's talk about another one that's involved. Somebody very different, about as different from Rand Paul as a person can be, and that's Jay-Z, who's about to enter into, or at least was about to enter into, a holiday collaboration of some kind with the upscale New York clothier Barney's. The problem, and Barney's, of course, is the kind of place where you can buy, you know, a $350 belt from Ferragamo. It's a very expensive place. It caters really to people who want to make super expensive purchases. The difficulty is that some of the people who've been going in there to make super expensive purchases are people of color, and that they have been, for no apparent other reason than the fact that they are people of color, detained. In particular, the teenager Trayon Christian, who used his debit card to buy a Ferragamo belt at Barney's New York, was detained. I'm reading from the Washington Post, not Wikipedia. I want to make that clear. Washington Post says was detained by police officers who accused him of making a fraudulent transaction. Christian said he was handcuffed and locked in a holding cell for about an hour before his name was cleared and he was released. He has filed a lawsuit against the store, the police, and the city. New York's attorney general has opened investigations of both Barney's and Macy's. Both stores have denied wrongdoing, but both of these stores and other stores as well have come under accusation for profiling customers of color and sometimes even just sort of refusing to accept the notion that they could be buying the hyper-expensive item that they're buying, which probably nobody should be buying anyway because it's way too much to pay for a baseball hat with rabbit ears or whatever it is that they're buying. One of the questions sort of that some people have been raising is, I mean, there's all kinds of people implicated in a thing like this. Why is Jay-Z having to bear the brunt of all this?
Well, why did they apologize to Jay-Z finally? When they sorted it all out, their expensive PR firm said, let's apologize to Jay-Z. Why not apologize to that kid?
You know? Isn't that the first thing we all have to think about? Has our behavior hurt
Jay-Z been wrong today?
In my morning reflections,
who pays the bill for the PR agency?
Yeah, right. I suppose so. I just couldn't. That was the part that floored me about all this. I mean, this stuff has been happening systematically there for a while. Wasn't even Oprah detained or questioned?
That was in Zurich, Europe, I believe.
Wherever that was. But so it's happening, and they have to find a way to deal with the fact that these are new clients and get with it. But apologizing to Jay-Z, of all people.
But the other random condemnation has been JP's supposed shameful silence that, you know, he let this kind of brouhaha unfold for a few days and he didn't say anything prophetic about it or significant about it.
Well, I think he was caught between a rock and a hard place with this because, you know, he's creating this line for Barney's and
An expensive hard place.
Yeah, he has money in the game, and this is the problem. He has his own PR people, and these people are all over the phones as soon as something like this happens. I mean, an ordinary person seeing something like this happen is going to think, "What are you crazy treating your customers like this?" You know, as a person who operates a movie theater, you know, you see the public all the time. You really give people the best you can, and you don't detain people. No, we don't detain people. I mean, it just boggles the mind to me that you could do that with a potential customer. Even if there was a doubt, you'd be very, very careful. To have the police come and grab somebody in a store like that is like taking it to another degree entirely. And then to have comments coming like that, sort of trying to escape from the responsibility of having done something like that, to actually have a PR-type response. I think that's a serious corporate problem now, is that the first reaction is to protect the corporation to protect the money. It's not about what's right or whether you did something wrong or whether it's a stupid policy to arrest somebody who happens to have bought a $350 belt and who happens to be black. That, okay, is that the store policy? Well, evidently it was. Somebody thought about this and decided to call the police in, or the police have some sort of orders that that's what they're supposed to be doing at an expensive store.
By the way, floating mics floating around, just stick up your hand if you got something you want to say about this. But yeah, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, I think that a lot of it has been that people were angry that Jay-Z didn't. I think people expected him to want to pull out his line and not be involved with this. But, you know, he did stress that his line is, you know, going to charity and this, that, and the other. But I think that it's, I don't know. I think that people... It's not just a problem with a race issue always, but these stores are snooty.
Yeah.
And they are. And I think that that needs to be addressed in general. I mean, I've been in stores where they're looking at me and being like, well, you're probably not going to afford this and not going to give you any attention. So
that's a good point.
In that sense, they're a great uniter. We're all trash, regardless of race, creed, or color.
Yep.
None of us are good enough for the store. And that's one thing that I would say about this is that some of this, I think, is also the result of living in the digital age in which we live, in which things are supposed to happen at really high speed. And I think probably Eisenhower had more time to craft his response to the downing of the U2 than Jay-Z did to respond to what happened at Barney's. In other words, it's a matter of hours.
I think he had 3 days, actually.
But that goes to the heart of the idea of a natural human response. Mm. I mean, if you hear that as a natural sort of, you know, human response, wait a minute, that's wrong. That shouldn't be happening. But on the other hand, if you take that time and you call your PR agency, and your PR agency says, well, you know, don't damage
your
contract.
I'll check Wikipedia.
You know, I'll check, yeah. That's what's phony to me, and I think that's what's behind a lot of PR disasters.
Well, I think we're seeing, you alluded to it as we were emailing around about this, we're seeing it at UConn right now,
right,
with the natural human response to a lot of young women who feel harassed or sexually assaulted or that these problems haven't been dealt with. The natural human response is, I am so sorry about that. I just would never want to see that happen.
Exactly.
Come to me. Let's talk about it. You know, I'm horrified that you feel that way. If you talk it over with the PR people, you get something different.
Right.
And you say something that probably exacerbates the problem.
Right. You come out swinging and you say, this is impossible. This could not happen. We are absolutely totally committed.
I think what she actually said was, this is inevitable that this is going to happen a few times.
Well, that was also a big mistake to say that.
Yeah.
That's a whole other show. I don't even think we could get bogged down there. In fact, we may have to move on. Although, I think we've got somebody in the audience.
Stop and frisk him first.
Yeah. He's got a very expensive-looking Barney's hat on.
Well, I guess my question is with Barney's in New York, is this just a spillover of the New York Police Department's stop and frisk policy? So is that just the culture in New York City these days?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll listen to the panel about this.
I think there's a lot of hostility to stop and frisk. In fact, it's just been the subject of another court ruling.
Yeah. They removed the judge.
Taking the judge who had made that ruling, stopping it, taking her off the case because the judge said that she acted improperly. You know, she went public, she went on TV and raised the issue, but it's certainly a hot issue in New York City, absolutely. And there's no way that those policemen outside Barney's, that they were there with the request of Barney's, no question. I mean,
they didn't just show up there that day.
They didn't just happen.
Maybe they were shopping.
Right. Maybe they were shopping.
Very expensive police
hats. Those expensive
hats. They need a new purse,
I mean, I think it's a great question, though. To me, it strikes me as a slightly different thing, which is it's the culture of a certain kind of store which hasn't, in fact, adjusted its expectations to the fact that there are rising classes of black and Latino people who can now afford to shop in the store and make the same kind of ill-advised, overpriced purchases that white people have been making for years and years. And there's something very horrifying about the reflexive attitude of a clerk that, oh, this person couldn't possibly afford this thing that they're about to buy. I mean, to me, obviously, the meaning of America is we should all be able to buy things at Barney's that cost way too much.
And maybe even more so in light of the fact that there's a giant gap growing between the haves and have-nots, and particularly in New York City. So how could this possibly happen here in New York, where I have a friend who used to go in there once a year with $50,000 and buy 3 suits and a sport jacket or something like that and shoes. So how could this possibly happen at a time like this?
Right. That's right. You don't look like a have, sir.
Right.
All right, we are going to quickly move on here. We've got one more topic, at least one more topic that we want to cover, and that's and James will kind of get us going through this. Ender's Game is opening all across the country right now. It's a science fiction movie. It's a science fiction movie based on a book that meant a lot to a lot of people. And I will say that I've never read this book, but that over the years, many, many people, not so much recently, but many, many people over the years since its publication would send me letters, or I think I may have been given at least one copy by somebody who said, you really have to read this book. It's exactly the kind of book that you would like. It means a lot to a lot of people for reasons that I don't entirely understand or divine. The difficulty with it is that the author of the book, Orson Scott Card, has kind of over the years with increasing frequency exhibited a lot of opinions that don't play that well with, in many cases, exactly the kind of people who might like his book. He's very active in the Church of Latter-day Saints, not that that's any problem, but he's also really, really active in anti-gay marriage causes, and then has been sort of spinning out these, of late, this year has spun out this kind of weird kind of science fiction, non-fiction scenario in which the Obamas refused to relinquish the White House, all of which isn't really great when you're opening your movie. Not that he apparently will share in the profits of this movie, but James, I'm going to hand the baton off to you. You're the one who got us started here. So flesh it out, maybe just set the stage better than I just did.
Well, the thing is that for a long time, there's been a lot of money, of course, behind Ender's Game, and it's greatly awaited by fans of the book. And it's something that the story itself has its whole issue of, you know, that it's about a society where young children essentially are the saviors of the human beings, in that they can fight the invading aliens. That's a very simple way of describing it. But the problem is that Orson Scott Card is a very, very vocal reactionary person, and he actually was on the board of the National Organization of Marriage, which was a very active group, still is, against same-sex marriage.
Didn't he help fund the Prop 13,
yes,
18 in
that's
California, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, so that's right. The proposition in California that ended briefly, or for a period, ended marriage in California. He was part of getting that money from the Mormon Church to do that, to back that. So he's had quite a history, and he's also he wrote this piece about Obama, comparing Obama to Hitler at one point in this piece in August. Then he comes up and he said, oh, it's just a story. I don't mean anything by it. Which, to me, gets to the heart of this thing. It's linked to plagiarism, really. It's like, throw it out there, see what sticks, you know, and see if you can get away with it, and then say, oh, I was just kidding. But the fact is that he's made really toxic pronouncements, and he's actually now, he certainly will benefit from the success of the film, and there's a lot of people who feel that buying a ticket for that picture is actually supporting the views of this person. Obviously, there's more to it than that, but it's again, we've been talking about money issues and you know, the haves and the have-nots. You've got a huge film here with a huge backing, a lot of investors who want to get their money back, and they don't want to talk about Orson Scott Card, but I do.
Well, we're talking about PR issues.
Right.
I mean, any press is good press. And to be honest, I had not, if you had mentioned him prior to this, if someone had mentioned Card, I was not familiar. I wouldn't have been able to tell you anything that he wrote.
Right.
And now I'm very well versed on this man, and now would, you know, a more aware of things that he has coming up. And then as far as his, you know, comparing Obama to Hitler and in this work, which, you know, we'll get more into in a second, I'm sure, but, you know, him saying, oh, it's just a story. I mean, it's the same as when people say, you know, your outfit is horrible. No offense.
Yeah, right.
Like, no
yeah.
offense. Obviously, that was an offense. Just saying. No. So, I mean, we're in a culture where if you put that sort of, like, caveat on it, where you're just kind of I'm not really saying this, but I did say it.
Yeah,
it makes it okay.
Yeah.
You know, Jim, in some respects, whenever I think of these kinds of questions, I always feel that, you know, be like Ted Nugent. If you're going to be obnoxious and have offensive views, create art that I don't want to listen to anyway.
I was just going to say, it does speak to a larger issue. It speaks to, like, you know, Ted Nugent is this ham-fisted guy using his politics as a cudgel and out there, like, literally saying, this is my market. And they know who I am. I'm going to spew racist baloney and I can say Obama is Hitler and a radical Christian and a Muslim, because that's what they expect of me. That's what they're buying. But it also speaks to this sort of other kind of thing in Hollywood. And I have to compare my own experience with it is that you turned me on to Ray Donovan, which has two pretty controversial actors in it, John Voight and James Woods. And there's nothing that freaks me out worse from an actor than a horrible Boston accent. And James, John Voight had a pretty good one, so I had to like reluctantly say, like, wow, he's doing a good job, even though I hate his politics. But James Woods' Boston accent sucked. And I was almost giddy with it. And I thought, he's doing a horrible job. And I know it's because I despise his politics. So I think this speaks to all of us in a personal way, because there's this sort of pivot that a lot of Hollywood personalities did after 9/11, where they kind of went to this radical right, and guys like John Voight and James Woods, and it sounds like Card was already there. But even David Mamet is now, or Mamet, as I will call him without the Colbert influence, has become this radical right-wing guy, and he wrote Glengarry Glen Ross. You know?
Well, I mean, I had this experience last night roaming the streets of Hartford with Penn Jillette, who is a fabulously entertaining person and a hilarious man who has brought me all kinds of joy over the years. I knew the whole time if we got to do a conversation about the Second Amendment or libertarians or other libertarian beliefs, we would not agree very much, and he's as loud and jerky about those as he is about things that he's truly funny about. But I want to go to James about this too, because it puts you in an interesting position as a real student of cinema. This is a long-awaited film. In fact, one of the central ironies of Ender's Game is that it's taken so long in development that we've watched the intellectual deterioration of Orson Scott Card. You know, he's a less appealing person today than he would have been when the movie was originally supposed to be made. But it's a long-awaited film. Supposedly the flying effects or the sort of anti-grav effects in the movie, at least at one point, were being talked about as, you know, kind of an interesting stage of those kinds of special effects. There may be other reasons to watch it. There are maybe other reasons to think about showing it at Cine Studio if it were an ordinary film with ordinary baggage, but it's not. So how do you, as a guy who's really interested in movies, knows as much about them as any human being as I've ever met, how are you going to sort that out? I mean, are you going to plunk down $10 to see this movie? I'm assuming you don't want to show it.
No, personally, I won't. As far as showing it and deciding whether to show it, we would have a long discussion about it, obviously, and a lot of people, we work kind of like a cooperative at Cine Studio, so students and people who work at Cine Studio, lots of people have input, and they will talk about it, and we've had big fights many years ago. We had a celebrated fight over the movie 10, whether that was sexist. And a lot of the women staff...
But whatever.
But it was. But it was fascinating that we had this long discussion. We ended up not showing the film because a large number of people on the staff felt that this was exploitation. Well, in the case of Ender's Game, there are other issues in it one of the things is that the kid in it, Ender Wiggins, is actually a thug. And the enemy are called buggers in the story. There's lots of sort of little clues that they certainly are red flags to me that what's going on there. So I would be a voice arguing against showing it.
So has the movie itself become politicized? Are people taking sides on the movie?
Or is it
just there's a website.
So, or is it just like a Michael Bay, like everybody dies?
There's a website that is specifically talking as geeks against, I forget the actual website.
It's called Geeks Out.
Geeks Out, that's right, is actually telling people to spend your money on other things. But then there are other people who are, you know, actually people who support same-sex marriage, for instance, who are saying, well, instead, you know, don't make such a big deal about this. Give some money to causes that you support. But I think that sort of escapes the issue. I mean, go ahead, give some money to causes you support. That's good. But you have to actually face this issue that people are associated. You are actually, when you buy a ticket, you are feeding money into the opinions of this person, and whether that person continues to act and continues to say things that personally I find offensive, that those are things that you make a statement about too. It seems reasonable to me that so we would have that discussion, certainly, and I can see it will happen before we show the film. And so when you come to that discussion, you decide, well, on the one hand, will it be hugely popular and we make a lot of money and we sell a lot of tickets, and then, you know, we can then afford to show something that it doesn't make a lot of money that actually is more socially acceptable, if you like, or something that is more progressive.
The less people would see.
The less people would see. So it's a complicated question, but I do think you have to air it. You have to bring it out. And the companies around Ender's Game have done their best in the last 6 months to suppress it, to actually hide it and make it something that, you know, not a big issue. You know, this is just
I read an article where they said it was gutted of its homophobia.
Yes, right. It's been
scrubbed.
You've already refuted.
We'll be the judge of that. Yeah. All right, we have to take a break here. I do encourage you this weekend, go to some place that's not Barney's, buy something nice, take a selfie of yourself not going to see Ender's Game, and then send it to somebody. I don't know who. Send it to Rand Paul. All right, so we're going to take a little break. We'll be back with more of The Nose after this.
Furious, aren't you? Stuck here in detention. I plagiarized and I liked it. Cut and pasted from Wikipedia. I plagiarized just to try it. One on one time for social media.
Our guests today are stout-bodied birds with short necks and have short, slender bills. Ugh, I plagiarized that from the Wikipedia article on pigeons. I am totally ashamed. This is worse than when I moved part of my multi-million euro song catalog from Ireland to Amsterdam 6 months before Ireland ended a tax exemption on musicians' royalties. Ugh, I plagiarized that from the Wikipedia entry about Bono. Where will it end? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with super assistance from the big kid, Katie Tolarski. Our interns are Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Harrison Ford. Check out all kinds of cool stuff, including photos from today at WNPR.org. Thanks to Greg Hill for tweets and voiceover help in the intro. On Monday, another mystery surprise show. And now, back to Colin.
Also got to give a big thank you to all the people here who make this happen, and that includes people whose names I don't even entirely know, but iConnect really helped out with this, and thanks to Christina Newman Hartford Scott from the Hartford Mayor's Office and everybody else who made this space possible for us. It's great. We're going to try to do more and more shows, Where We Live and the Colin McEnroe Show, coming down here to Hartford, as well as in New Haven. We're going to get out. We're going to get out a little bit more. All right, so we're going to do plugs and we're going to do endorsements. Fortunately, I don't have almost nothing to plug, except that I do want to mention that Grayson Hugh, whose voice usually comes on at the end of the show and who's a fabulous musician, has worked with Jim Chapdelaine, will be at the Bridge in Collinsville tonight, which will be a nice place to see Grayson. Go out and see him and Polly Messer. They're fabulous. If you haven't caught this act before and you're wondering what to do tonight, do that. And Carolyn, you've got like a big performing thing this weekend.
Yeah, I have been doing some of the comedy tour with Hannibal Buress in a sketch with him. Yeah, so that's pretty, I'm doing that this weekend. And we're down in Yale, at Yale, doing his show. He does a wonderful sketch where he does his rap, his gibberish rap, and I'm part of that.
I'm getting a one-minute signal, which is really frightening me. Really fast endorsements.
A really quick one. November 16th at Cine Studio, we have a wonderful party called Pixelation, which celebrates cinema, and everybody's invited. You can go online to cinestudio.org, and we're showing Young Frankenstein, and Colin will be there, and we're
It'll
having
be great.
A great time.
Jim, really fast.
I'm known for my geeky endorsements. I'm going to outdo myself. Code Academy. Last night I went on at 12 o'clock, and I built a website by 12:15, you could do it too. It's
Code
cool.
Code Academy?
And then, yeah, it's
and you build
it's
a website
cool.
there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my website was just three words, but yeah. I did build it. And then Jessica Lange, an American Horror Story. I don't really like the show, but just to watch Jessica Lange is like unbelievable. She's at the peak, I think. Russell Brand's rant on YouTube, and thank you, Boston Red Sox.
All right. They gave me another minute. Now they gave me just two more minutes. They just keep adding
Let's
time back on
the website.
So I'll mention a couple of things really quickly here then. I'm so late
I don't
getting...
get to endorse anything?
Well, you endorse something. Endorse something good.
Okay. I just wanted to endorse. I was in Montreal recently. It's an amazing city. Go there. It's like 5-6 hours away, and go to the Biodome in Montreal.
Biodome is good.
Yes.
All right, so I'm very late getting on this train, but if you like podcasts and you haven't discovered Welcome to Night Vale, this is an amazing amazing podcast. It's basically about a place. It's sort of a combination of The X-Files and Prairie Home Companion. It's about a little town where every conspiracy theory is true. And you can either listen on your phone or you can sort of go, I'll put it on my laptop and listen to a bunch of different episodes all together. It's fabulous. I mean, what they've done with sound there is incredible. And then this is, so that's sort of, it's not really highbrow exactly, but it's esoteric anyway. And then I think you could just find this by Googling the following words. Miley Cyrus MTV performance narrated by David Attenborough. And so what they've done is taken Miley Cyrus and Robin Thicke and superimposed a David Attenborough nature documentary about, you know, presenting and fully and coloration and feathers. And you can pretty much work it all out from there. But it's... you really kind of have to watch it. All right. Thanks so much. How about a big hand for Hartford, for iConnect, for all the people who helped out getting this space. We'll be back on Monday with a mystery surprise show.
As a matter of fact, oh, yeah. Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, Yeah.
She on the radio.
On the radio, baby. You and me talking about it now.
Oh, Kyone Wolf. You died so young. So unexpected.
What, I can't take a selfie at my own funeral? Lighten up, guys.